Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's practice groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. My name is Edith Harold, and I'm an Assistant Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this Courthouse Steps Decision webinar discussing Ryan LLC versus the Federal Trade Commission. Speaking on the panel today, we have Andrew Kilberg of Gibson Dunn and Judson Littleton of Sullivan and Cromwell, both litigators in this case. Moderating today, we are joined by Ashish Agarwal, a consultant to the American Edge Project and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. If you'd like to learn more about today's moderator or speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. Near the end of the program, we will turn to the audience for questions. If you have a question, you can enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers, not the Federalist Society. And with that, Ashish, thank you for joining us today, and I'll hand things over to you.
Well, thank you very much, Edith, and thank you very much to the Federal Society for hosting this very timely panel. So as you may have seen, last week, a federal court in Texas invalidated the FTC's rule banning the use of non-compete clauses, a rule that had been scheduled to take effect next week. The decision affects millions of employers and employees around the country, and it could permanently limit the FTC's rulemaking authority. And there's even more. This is perhaps the first case, certainly one of the first cases, to apply Loper-Bright. And the court's opinion could give us a glimpse into the post-Chevron world. Today, we're privileged to be joined by two of the lead litigators in that case. Andrew Kilberg, partner with Gibson Dunn, an alumnus of the Secretary's Office at the U.S. Department of Labor. He clerked for Justice Kennedy on the Supreme Court and Judge Wilkinson on the Fourth Circuit. Judd Littleton is a partner at Sullivan and Cromwell and co-heads the firm's Supreme Court and appellate practice. He's an alumnus of DOJ's Civil Division and clerked for Chief Justice Roberts and Judge Randolph on the Fourth Circuit. And I'm your moderator, Ashish Agarwal, also an alumnus of several agencies and a consultant to the U.S. Chamber and American Edge Project. I should mention that the Chamber was one of the plaintiffs in this case, where it was ably represented by Judd and his team. So let's get to it. Andrew, for people who haven't been following this case maybe super closely, could you provide an overview of the rule, the FTC's justification, and the court's decision?
Thanks, Ashish. It's good to see you again. Ashish left out that he and I worked together a bit at the Department of Labor, go way back. And it's been a privilege to be here with FedSoc today. The ban was a ban. The April 23rd, the FTC released its final rule, which invalidated retroactively and prospectively nearly all non-competes in the country. It was, I think, by the FTC's own estimate, approximately 99% of non-compete agreements were covered by the rule. And really only had two very narrow exceptions, one for existing non-competes with senior executives. I should put scare quotes around senior executives because it was a fairly narrow definition of who would fall within that category. And that exception only would have covered pre-existing non-competes. The rule still would have banned new non-competes with senior executives. Also was an exception for non-competes entered into pursuant to a sale of a business. Again, a fairly narrow exception that was in the rule. And it really even went beyond that. The FTC had indicated in the rule text and also in the preamble that so-called functional non-competes, by which they meant other restrictive covenants, potentially including non-solicit clauses, non-hire, or even certain non-disclosure agreements could possibly have been considered non-competes under the rule's application. So it was a very broad rule, really one of the, if not the most consequential and controversial employment-related regulations ever, certainly within the last 25 years in this century. Obviously it drawn a lot of attention, tens of thousands of comments, I believe, in the comment period. And really saw the FTC getting far beyond its authority. So on April 23rd, when the rule came out, Gibson Dunn, representing Ryan LLC, a consultancy firm in Texas, filed suit in the Northern District of Texas. Sullivan and Cromwell, representing the Chamber of Commerce, as well as the Business Roundtable, Texas Association of Business, and Judd can correct me if I'm getting this wrong, but I believe the Longview Chamber of Commerce filed suit in the Eastern District shortly after Ryan did. Ultimately, the Eastern District asked the Sullivan and Cromwell representative plaintiffs to join our case in the Northern District, which they did. And then working hand in glove together, we first obtained a preliminary injunction and a stay of the rule that applied just to the named parties. And then, Ashish, as you mentioned, last Tuesday, Judge Ada Brown in the Northern District invalidated the rule as a whole, as applied to all parties, not party restricted, a nationwide set aside of the final rule or the APA. Fundamentally, her decision hit on two grounds that I think, two kind of fundamental types of grounds that betrayed the lack of authority and the unreasonableness of the FTC's rule. The FTC had relied on authority in a subsection, a second clause in a subsection of one section of the FTC Act. So Section 6 mostly has to do with investigative authorities. There is a subsection G that allows the FTC from time to time to classify corporations. And then the back half of that refers to rulemaking authority and aid of its powers under the FTC Act. And the FTC relied on that section in its entirety for their rulemaking authority, pointing to Section 5 as well of the Act, which is their actual substantive authority to prevent unfair methods of competition. But Section 5 itself lays out a comprehensive scheme, as Judge Brown found, to combat unfair methods of competition where and when they exist through case-by-case adjudication. And looking through the history of the FTC Act from its inception, how it's been applied, and subsequent amendments by Congress, Judge Brown correctly found that there is no substantive rulemaking authority within Section G, notwithstanding the FTC's claim of authority to the otherwise. So in a fairly succinct, concise opinion, she reached the right conclusion with respect to substantive rulemaking authority. She also, and to be clear, there are other grounds and arguments that the parties had raised that are relevant to that, but she found it unnecessary to reach necessarily all the arguments that the plaintiffs and plaintiff interveners had raised in support of our claims. She also did rule in part, I'm sorry, she
Go ahead, Andrew. I was just going to follow up on that a little bit and ask you whether the court got into, the major questions doctrine and some of the other constitutional issues.
Right. So that's a good question. We had raised the major questions doctrine, and Ryan had also raised non-delegation doctrine, but the judge did not see the need to reach those arguments. Yes, obviously, major questions doctrine has been a topic of much discussion in recent years, particularly in light of the Supreme Court clearly articulating it in exactly that term, giving it a name once and for all. But the clarity, I think, of our position meant that the judge didn't need to reach it. The non-delegation doctrine argument is interesting. There's different flavors of it, but ultimately, when it comes down to it, if the FTC does have substantive rulemaking authority to define unfair methods of competition that apply across the country to all employers and all industries and all circumstances, that is a extraordinary grant of authority. And you would expect some clarity and guidelines as to how the FTC is actually going to apply it. And in short, there is no such guidelines or guidance or intelligible principle, to use kind of the key legal term from Supreme Court case law. There is no such guidance in the FTC Act. And the FTC, would be left to its own devices to do nearly anything it could imagine that it could call unfair and relate to competition.
Thanks, Andrew. Judd, let's turn to you. How does this decision fit into the overall framework of the non-compete litigation. What has the FTC said about an appeal in this case? There are some other cases pending. Could you talk about the big picture?
Of course. And thanks again. I echo the thanks that Andrew offered it first. Thanks to the Federalist Society and to you, Ashish, for having me on this and moderating this. This is great. So to start with what the FTC has said kind of about our case, they haven't done anything yet. And we've been kind of waiting kind of each passing hour to see if something actually happens. I think a spokesman said immediately after the decision that the agency was seriously considering an appeal. They have said something similar in one of the other cases that you referenced in a filing in the other case. They said they're considering appellate options, but we still don't know exactly what they're going to do. It's hard to imagine that they won't appeal, but we haven't seen any action yet in terms of what they will do. In terms of what that appeal might focus on, again, of course, we don't know, but I like to think of the case as kind of involving two buckets based on how it was briefed and how it came out in the decision. So first is the merits bucket, which is kind of everything that Andrew's been talking about. The court's determination that the FTC doesn't have any authority to issue rules about unfair methods of competition, and the fact that the rule was arbitrary and capricious. The FTC didn't really do its homework and rationalize its decision to adopt this total ban. Those are kind of the merits. And I think, you know, we would expect that the FTC will pursue an appeal at the merits. The other aspect of it is the scope of relief point that Andrew has mentioned, which, you know, in the initial preliminary injunction order that she issued, the relief was limited only to the named parties to the litigation. And there was a lot of briefing in the summary judgment stage about whether the court should or had the power to extend relief not only to the parties to the litigation, but to the whole country. And as Andrew noted, in about a paragraph of analysis at the end of the order, Judge Brown said that the rule would be set aside in its entirety. So that's relief that is not limited to just the parties, but it is kind of wiping the rule off of the books as applied to anyone in the country. So I think those are the two buckets that may come up in appeal, but we don't know. The short answer is we don't know what the FTC is going to do in our case. As for the kind of broader landscape of litigation against this particular rule, people may know that there are two other cases that are ongoing at the moment. There is one in the Eastern District of Pennsylvania in front of Judge Hodge that was brought by a company called ATS Tree Services, which is a tree care company. And then there's a second case that is pending in the Middle District of Florida in front of Chief Judge Corrigan. It is brought by a real estate broker called Property of the Villages. Both of those cases are a little bit behind ours. They've both gotten to the preliminary injunction stage, but they haven't gotten beyond that so far. So in the Philadelphia case, the ATS Tree Services case, the plaintiff there, ATS, moved for a preliminary injunction and the judge denied it and said that they were not entitled to preliminary injunctive relief. And so in that case, the parties are now have proposed a schedule to the court for briefing summary judgment and getting to the question of whether a permanent injunction like what Judge Brown entered in our case is appropriate. And just the only thing to note, it's a little in the weeds. The parties proposed a schedule that would have asked for a decision by November 27th, and the judge actually extended the briefing schedule and declined to promise a decision by any certain date. So we don't really know when a decision is going to come out in that case. The preliminary indication is that, you know, I think ATS is maybe less likely to prevail in that case, given what the judge said at the preliminary injunction stage. But, you know, that's why we file the briefs. You never know. The second case is the Property of the Villages case, the case that's pending in Florida. And in that case, Chief Judge Corrigan granted preliminary injunctive relief only to the plaintiff there, to Properties of the Villages. And the parties have, basically proposed that that case be put on hold for a period of 30 days while DOJ considers its appellate options, both in that case and in our case. And so the, you know, that case is a little bit behind. They're supposed to file a status report a month from now, late September, proposing what they want to do on summary judgment.
That's very helpful, Judd. And it's, you know, it's still early stages. We don't have a single appellate decision yet. But as you, you know, think about this and game this out, which I'm sure you have, you know, what are the chances that this might go all the way up, that we might get a circle split?
So I think it is reasonably likely. I mean, assuming it goes up on appeal and we, you know, being in the Fifth Circuit, we would obviously, you know, defend Judge Brown's decision very strenuously. And we hope that we would get a favorable decision affirming that decision from the Fifth Circuit. And at that point, if that happens, there is already a circuit split because this D.C. Circuit opinion from the 1970s that is the only case that has kind of addressed whether the agency, whether the FTC has rulemaking authority for unfair methods of competition, it said that the agency does have that authority. We obviously quibble with that analysis of that case, but the agency cited that case throughout the rule, throughout its briefs, as support for the fact that it had the authority under Section 6 that Andrew explained to adopt this rule. And so that decision is going that way. And if the Fifth Circuit comes out in our favor, there is already a circuit split. So I think, you know, that box is checked. I also think it is a very important statutory issue and very, you know, consequential for the government. And so to the extent that the Fifth Circuit rules in our favor and the SG asks the Supreme Court to review that decision, it's, you know, it's hard for me to see the Supreme Court saying no to that.
Interesting stuff. I'm going to ask a question from a very good question from the audience. This is for either one of you who would like to take this. I believe this case was correctly decided to appropriately stem the gross overreach of the FTC. That's in the question. Can you discuss how one district court has the authority to void the rule nationwide? Who'd like to tackle that?
I mean,
I'll jump in.
Hey, go ahead.
We've thought about this a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, the authority, and then Andrew can follow up and kind of jump on anything that I missed. I mean, the authority that we argue is really from the text of the APA itself. It says in the sort of provision 706 that says what a judge can do in reviewing a regulation adopted by an agency is that it can set aside the rule. And that term has been interpreted by a number of courts and very often and very strongly by the Fifth Circuit in the past few years as meaning setting aside the rule means vacating the rule, which means essentially wiping it from the books as though it doesn't exist. And that kind of relief is kind of inherently universal and nationwide. It's important to note the distinction between that kind of relief, setting aside the rule, vacating the rule, wiping it off the books, from the nationwide injunctions, which are different and have gotten a lot more kind of notoriety, I think, over the years in some of the prior administration. A lot of people kind of object to this idea of, you know, one district judge in one corner of the country enjoining the federal government from doing anything all abroad across the whole country. That's a separate form of relief, and it's something distinct and something that Judge Brown did not do, that from the APA authority that is expressly granted by the statute to set aside the rule.
Yeah, I agree with that analysis. I mean, it's what's important to remember is how the APA works in this context with the remedy of set aside is it's operating on the rule, right? So it's as if in this context, the trial was the rulemaking process and the district court summary judgment proceeding is kind of like an appeal. I mean, the administrative record is the discovery and that sets the record. And then in the substantive merits are the appeal of that, you know, agency decision. Obviously, we still have an appeal within the federal court system of the Fifth Circuit to potentially contend with, as Judd was explaining. But when you think of it that way, it doesn't raise the same kind of concerns that people have been articulating in recent years over the last, 5-10 years about nationwide injunctions.
Let's turn to the very, very practical question about what employers and employees should be thinking about now. So it sounds like there is some chance, at least, that the rule, you know, could be coming back depending on how the litigation plays out, and recognizing that neither one of you are providing legal advice to the audience here, what would you encourage, you know, employers and employees to think about who have existing non-competes and who might be thinking about entering into new ones? Andrew, for this one, let's start with you.
Sure. Yeah. You know, look, this is a major action, and it would have banned, as I said, 99% or more of non-competes nationwide. But it's not the federal government and the Federal Trade Commission are not the only players in this space. States have been much more active in the last decade or so in looking at their own state law as to non-competes and similar restrictive covenants. So I think, I'm not giving legal advice to any particular listener, but, you know, a reasonable place to start is to inventory your agreements, your handbooks. And by agreements, I mean employer agreements. It could be severance agreements, could be stock equity award agreements or other types of employment related contracts you have, to see what restrictive covenants are in there. And to really, you know, potentially consult with a counsel as to how enforceable those would be in your various jurisdictions. We've also seen some, and I should say on that, you know, there are varieties of this. Some states ban non-competes with low wage workers or workers in, you know, a certain industry, or have other restrictions on how restrictive covenants must be drafted in order for them to be enforceable. And of course, there's large bodies of case law from the, you know, decades, if not hundreds of years, that these clauses have been litigated that set bounds on the reasonableness and what can be enforced in various jurisdictions. And also, there has been some interest in Congress with non-competes. There's been bills that have been introduced from time to time over the past few Congresses. As we all know, it can be difficult to get a bill through both houses and even out of committee in a single house at times. But there's been attention focused on it. So it's possible that you could see congressional action. So one thing that I've always liked to say on webinars like this over the last year or so, as this issue has been percolating through the FTC and through litigation, is if this means something to you, you know, it's well within your rights and it might be in your interest to engage with local representatives and with your congressional representatives to make it clear why these agreements are important to business and are important to your industry. To have, and also to be willing to understand what, you know, reasonable limits on them might be.
Good. A procedural question from the audience. Judge, I'm going to direct this one to you, and then we'll get back to talking about, you know, non-competes. Why aren't the Pennsylvania and Florida cases moot in light of the Texas case? How could the Pennsylvania and Florida courts reinstate a rule already vacated under the APA?
It's a great question, you could see how judges might decide when it comes down to it to say, I see a judge that has entered an order vacating the rule, setting aside the rule, and I'm at least going to stay or hold this proceeding in abeyance while that decision goes up on appeal. I don't think that they are compelled to do so, especially while an appeal is pending. But of course, once it goes up through the appellate process, and if it got to the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court said that, affirms that decision, then that would, I think, moot any kind of pending litigation. But I think right now the key is just it's a district court decision that has not yet become final, and so doesn't really have the sort of final nationwide effect for purposes of other pending litigation at the moment. It's a good question.
Judd, I'd like to build on something that Andrew was talking about in response to the previous question, which is, what might happen next from a policymaker standpoint. I think, you know, a number of observers, including the chamber, have acknowledged that some non-competes, can, certainly appear to be, overly restrictive. So in light of this decision, what tools do policymakers have, to look at this issue if they are concerned about that?
Yeah, I mean, and that's an important point, Ashish, to highlight is that, I don't think any of us were in the litigation, have been in this litigation, including the chamber, arguing that all non-competes are okay. And there are some, no one's kind of contesting the point that some probably go too far. First, I think that there are a few different ways that, and Andrew alluded to a few different ways that non-competes can still, kind of be regulated despite the court's decision last week. So first, let's consider the FTC's options. I mean, the FTC, as we argued in the papers, has always had the authority to bring individual enforcement actions based on unfair methods of competition. The dispute was about whether they can do a rulemaking that kind of sets a rule for across the whole country. And the court correctly, in our view, held that they don't have that, but they do have the authority to initiate individual enforcement actions alleging that particular non-compete agreements are unfair. So assuming that this litigation stands, the result here stands, I think the FTC and depending on the administration, you might see continued enforcement activity along those lines. The NLRB, I should mention, as another agency, has come out, the general counsel of the NLRB came out with a memo last year saying that their conclusion is that non-competes violate the National Labor Relations Act. And there have been a couple of cases before ALJs in front of the board in which the board has prevailed in showing that particular non-compete provisions are overly broad, too expansive. So those are kind of two federal agency routes that could still be pursued. Congressional efforts, as Andrew mentioned, I think there are a couple of bills that were proposed pretty recently that are still pending. And, you know, there's a lot of talk about revitalizing those bills in the wake of the decision last week in the public. Who knows with Congress, as Andrew said, bicameralism is tough. And then in the states, as Andrew also mentioned, there's a lot of activity in the states in regulating non-competes. That's another thing that we have consistently, if you read our briefs, we kind of emphasize the long history of the states regulating non-competes. And that's something that's very appropriate for the states to do. And there's really been a lot of increased activity in recent years. There are, I think, as we count, about four states that effectively banned them altogether. None of them kind of went as far as the non-compete rule because of this functional test, this vague functional test that Andrew mentioned earlier. But California, North Dakota, Oklahoma, and most recently, I think, Minnesota have basically banned non-compete agreements in those states. I think there are a few other states where the legislatures adopted bans on non-competes or close to bans on non-competes, and then they were vetoed by the governor of those states in Rhode Island and Maine and in New York. And then in Washington state, you know, you've got a bill that recently went into effect that actually really expands employee protections against non-competes. And so to the extent that the states are experimenting in those areas and either adopting kind of near complete bans on them or kind of putting restrictions on them in terms of geographic scope, how long the term can last, what kind of salary threshold. There are several states, I think 11 states maybe, that have salary thresholds that say employees making less than X amount of money, you can't use a non-compete for those. So I think states are going to continue to, you know, be active in this area and experiment with different limitations. And like I said, maybe some will adopt total bans, but this all kind of goes to Andrew's point that people who really care about this and businesses who feel strongly about this should engage their representatives on this, the good old democratic process, right?
And the beauty of federalism.
That's right.
Were you going to say something? Otherwise, I have a specific question.
I was just going to say, you know, Judd mentioned earlier the spokesperson for the agency after the decision mentioned, you know, that they were seriously considering an appeal. They also, that statement, I believe, given to several outlets, indicated that they, you know, still have this case by case authority. So time will tell, you know, assuming that our victory is upheld, whether how aggressively the FTC uses its case by case authority to try to make non-compete cases out there. It is, I think, two points on that is that until maybe days before the proposed rule had even come out, the commission had not brought, much less successfully, any non-compete case in a very long time. And those were consent decrees that they had announced just a few days before the proposed rule. I think my recollection is the last time the commission really even attempted to enforce against a non-compete agreement was in the early 60s or late 50s, which the commission then lost that case in a decision that by the Seventh Circuit that found that restrictive covenants are legal if they are reasonably tailored. So, time will tell how strong their authority is. And again, this is really against the backdrop of not just decades within the United States, but hundreds of years. I mean, I think the first case within English common law that found that a non-compete can be legal if it's reasonably tailored goes all the way back to 1711. So this is not something that is new or newfangled, business practice. This is hundreds of years of history.
Andrew, I have a question for you from a well-informed audience member. Is National Petroleum the only case before the current set of district court cases saying that the FTC had competition rulemaking authority? There's a belief that maybe one of the decisions has suggested that there was a second prior case suggesting that.
Yeah, so I think what that's referring to, National Petroleum held, if I'm recalling correctly, that there is substantive rulemaking authority in 6G. I would posit that the FTC has never until this rule actually done a real bona fide unfair method of competition rule. There's about maybe 10 to 15 years where the FTC was putting out substantive rules under 6G. But when you really dig in, those are all unfair deceptive act or practices rules, and that kind of tacked on at the end. It's an unfair method of competition. This is all laid out, and I think some of the Gibson Dunn Ryan briefs really taking issue with this kind of the FTC's attempt to backfill history when it doesn't really actually fit with their narrative of the statutory evolution over time. I think the reference to a second case was that there may have been another appellate court decision that effectively just cited National Petroleum without engaging in really much additional analysis. So, when the parties really dig into it, really we're talking about National Petroleum as the only other case on that other side. And this was also before the Magnuson-Moss Act, where Congress specifically granted substantive rulemaking authority or rulemaking authority, with respect to UDAPs, to unfair deceptive acts or practices, and very clearly did not weigh in on the question of whether there is authority with respect to unfair methods of competition, kind of left that question out there. So ultimately, to go back to something Judd said, there is this split of authority with respect to what 6G means, but there hasn't been a substantive case that I'm aware of that really addresses straightforwardly our current context of the world after the Magnuson-Moss Act. It's a huge case, obviously, in many respects. But that's, I think one nuance about kind of the history of the court decisions and their timing.
Another interesting constitutional question. Judd, let's start with you on this one, if you don't mind. Was any contract clause argument made in the case to the extent that the rule applied retroactively? So I'm also going to ask you to remind our listeners what the contract clause in the Constitution is. And then, go ahead.
Put me on the spot there. Yeah. So I think Article 1, Clause 10 or Section 10, I think, says that no state can impair the right of contract. I'm a little fuzzy on that. The short answer is maybe you can infer by me being fuzzy on what exactly that provision says, is that we didn't make a specific argument under the contract clause, but we did make a retroactivity argument, which I think that you alluded to, based on this kind of invalidation of existing agreements. And we said, essentially we leaned mostly on a statutory argument. There's good law from the Supreme Court saying that, to the extent agencies want to enact retroactive regulations, they have to have clear statutory authority in order to do so. So I think that there's a due process argument, and there are, maybe contract clause arguments in particular cases that would follow on from that. But at the very least, as a statutory matter, agencies don't have authority to act retroactively unless they have a clear statement from Congress authorizing them to do so. And so we said in this case that what the agency is doing by trying to invalidate all existing non-competes, except for those for the mushy senior executives that Andrew referenced, that that is essentially retroactive rulemaking that, of course, the FTC can't point to any clear statutory authority to do. So the court didn't address that, didn't have a need to, because, you know, she had invalidated the entire rule. But we did make that sort of a retroactivity argument, just more as a statutory interpretation matter.
Another audience question, which I'm pretty sure we've covered, but because it is so, you know, important, and, you know, employers and employees around the country are looking at this, I'll go ahead and ask it. If one of the other courts upholds the rule vacated by the Texas court, can employers nationwide rely on the Texas case? Jed, I know you talked about that earlier. Andrew, do you just want to give your perspective on that?
Yeah, our decision is it's a final judgment, and it operates on the rule. So, you know, if there is a decision out of Florida or Pennsylvania that goes the other way, so long as our judgment is not been reversed, it's there, it's binding. So that's the short answer. The answer is yes. Our you can rely on our judgment, is my view.
Here's an interesting case that gets to what's going to come next in terms of, here's an interesting question from the audience about what might happen next in terms of enforcement actions. Judd, I'll start with you on this. In a non-rule individual enforcement action, do panel members think that the FTC would have to show unfairness of a non-compete as between an employer and employee, or as between competitors? Interesting, two competing employers. Judd, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, this is very untested because, as Andrew was saying, you know, there is really no history of the FTC successfully going after non-competes. And I haven't read, you know, predating the sort of two consent decree cases that they finalized basically immediately before this rule was adopted, to sort of tee that up. Those weren't litigated. They weren't contested. I haven't gone back and read those closely very recently. My recollection is that there is not sort of a comparison of kind of one employer's non-competes as compared to their competitors' non-competes agreements. It's more about the allegedly unfair restriction of the employee's rights to go to a different employer that the agency effectively argued went too far. And I think in both of those cases, Andrew can correct me if I'm wrong, in at least one of those cases, involving, I think, a Michigan security company, the non-competes had already been held unlawful under state law as having gone too far. And the FTC just kind of piled on with a consent decree saying, yeah, we think it's unfair too, basically in order to build up some precedent before this rule. But to answer the question, I don't recall that the analysis is, you know, kind of how restrictive are yours versus how restrictive are your competitors? But, you know, again, this is not litigated even in front of the FTC as far as what exactly they would have to show.
Andrew, anything to add there?
I haven't reread those in a while, so I'm not sure I can comment on the specificity of that more. But I will say that, you know, with this, the way that this FTC has been approaching things the last few years, they have shown an inclination, and I think expressly articulated, that they are looking to insert labor and employment considerations more squarely into their, you know, a lot of what their actions are, not just with respect to this rule. And so it wouldn't surprise me to see them continue along those lines in other areas, including in individual enforcement actions coming down the road. And by that, I mean, I think there is an indication that they're pretty clearly, particularly with the November 2022 policy statement they put out, showing that they want to go beyond what has been accepted and the typical consumer protection mission that the agency has had, and how it has approached determining whether there has been an unfair method of competition.
Let's talk a little bit more about the, you know, ad law aspects of this. The court held that the rule was arbitrary and capricious because it was unreasonably overbroad without a reasonable explanation. So, you know, talk a little bit about, and this is for either one of you, you know, talk a little bit about the impact that Loper Bright had on this case. And as one of the early post, you know, Chevron cases, what does this tell us, if anything, about how courts are going to interpret that decision?
So I'll say, as an initial matter, I do think one thing that's important, because you mentioned sort of the arbitrary and capricious aspect of the decision and sort of how the agency's justifications weren't sufficient to support the overbroad rule. And then Loper-Bright, on the other hand, those are really kind of addressing two separate things, right? So Loper-Bright is really just about the statutory question. So how does the court interpret whether the agency has authority to do the thing that it's doing? And so in that instance, it is, you know, what Loper-Bright says is, you know, courts, you don't put the thumb on the scale of the agency anymore. You have to come to your best reading of the statute to figure out whether you think the agency has the authority to do what it's claiming that it has the authority to do. Can't put your thumb on the scale anymore. And in this case, you know, I think Judge Brown cites Loper-Bright a few times, but she didn't even have to. She was engaging in her own independent statutory analysis of Section 6G from the beginning. I do think on the sort of the arbitrary and capricious point, while it's not generally, you know, directly relevant as a legal matter to the Loper-Bright statutory interpretation question, these are kind of a piece of other things that, you know, trends that you are seeing in the courts these days, from the Supreme Court on down to lower courts, which is courts are taking a much harder look at agencies' reasoning and the quality of their reasoning in justifying the rules that they adopted than I think you might have seen and what I remember learning in law school about arbitrary and capricious review back in the 1970s and 80s. The courts are taking a very hard look at why is the agency adopting this rule? Why does the agency think it's appropriate? What are the comments that it received that are showing kind of flaws in its reasoning, or whether, you know, more limited options that it should have taken? And we pointed to all of those kinds of comments here. We said, look, you have comments saying you should have adopted salary thresholds. You could have adopted more limited, you know, other kind of more targeted restrictions. None of your evidence that you cite in your proposed rule actually supports a categorical ban, because no such categorical ban has ever been tried before. And so, you know, I think in historical practice, you know, back in the days of National Petroleum in the 1970s, you might have seen a court kind of more willing to just kind of rubber stamp what the agency says, well, you know, they're the expert. So if they say that the rule is justified, I'm going to pretty much defer to that. But you're not seeing that. That's a different world than we're living in now, at least, you know, in the Supreme Court and in the Fifth Circuit and some of the other courts that are taking a much harder look at agency decisions these days.
Great. We have another. Andrew, did you have anything to add?
No, sorry. Just coming off.
Another procedural question regarding Judson's point regarding retroactivity. Is that limited to rulemaking under the APA, or does it also extend to case adjudications by agencies? For example, when the NLRB decides to overturn precedent, they routinely apply their decisions retroactively to all cases at whatever stage of the proceedings. Judd or Andrew, who'd like to tackle that?
Yeah, I think, I don't know if Andrew may have a bit more of the NLRB specific experience than I do. I'm not sure. But you know, my understanding of the relevant distinction between what we were arguing in our case and the NLRB situation that you're contemplating there is it's never really thought to be retroactive to apply, you know, for instance, in the court context, in the judicial context, to apply a decision of an appellate court or the Supreme Court to all cases that are kind of pending as of that period of time. So, you know, new precedent affects a change in the law. That is not it is not retroactive to apply that precedent to all cases that are kind of pending at whatever stages the proceedings are at the time that the decision is rendered. That's never really been understood to be retroactive. I think the distinguishing feature that we pointed to here was, of course, you know, all of these non-compete agreements that, you know, the 30 million agreements that the FTC admitted that it was probably invalidating existed, and they were not being challenged. They were not subject to any proceeding, but the rule was just purporting to kind of wipe them off the books and invalidate them retroactively. I think that limitation, what we argued, is that is retroactive rulemaking. And I think that if an agency, you know, if the NLRB tried to do that, something like that, in the context of an adjudication, I would think that we'd be making the same argument. And I'm not sure that there would be any relevant difference between adjudication and rulemaking for that purpose.
Andrew, let me throw another audience question to you, which is basically getting at, is there private enforcement of the rule? So the question is, does the FTC, if the rule is at some point upheld, does the FTC need to be a party to an action enforcing the rule, or can any employee point to the rule as a defense to an action by a former employer to enforce a non-compete?
Yeah, great question. I mean, so in a world where the rule is effective and exists, then an important piece of this that I omitted from my summary at the top is that the FTC's rule purported to preempt all less restrictive state law, including common law. They're very careful to say including common law. That's why we talk about this being an invalidation of 30 million contracts and a ban on all non-competes moving forward. In that world where the rule exists, it would mean that, I think that an employee and say an employer tried to enforce a non-compete, an employee would defend by saying, well, my non-compete's not enforceable, and point to the FTC rule. It's not a cause of action directly, but it does result ultimately and would have resulted ultimately in private enforcement in that means.
Could I just add one more thing to that, Ashish? Because that is that I completely agree with everything Andrew said, kind of on the federal level. The only other thing I would note is that on the state level, there are a lot of kind of state consumer protection laws and state attorneys general who are, very friendly to these, to this policy, might use those laws. And a lot of state consumer protection laws define violations by reference to FTC rules and federal agency rules. And so I think that there is a possibility that if this rule is in effect, you're not only dealing with the potential for federal enforcement or kind of using the rule as a defense in a private litigation, but you're also dealing with the, possibility of state attorneys general saying that under their state consumer protection laws, you've violated it for violating the FTC rule. And a lot of those state laws have private rights of action for affected people.
That's a great point. Another audience question. Mm-hmm. And thank you to the audience for asking such a great question. This really makes my job a lot easier.
These are great questions.
Question. Andrew, we'll just go to you for this one in the first instance. Agency rules now appear to flip-flop with each change in administration. Is this causing courts to be more skeptical of agency action?
I mean, I think so. It probably depends on the court, on the judge, but I think Justice Kavanaugh articulated this in oral argument during Loper-Bright or Relentless, I forget which one, saying pretty expressly that courts are kind of throwing their hands up and saying, how do we really, think that put much credence in what the agency's finding if it's changing every 4 to 8 years or sometimes faster? Particularly if you have midnight regulations that are then getting pulled back immediately by the next administration or sometimes put on ice, by an executive order, for example, within days. Now, he was commenting in the context of Chevron, but I think that it probably is playing some role in how judges are looking at the reasonableness of preambles. I also do think that there's something to the fact that some agencies have been, pretty aggressive in some of their policy choices, even setting aside whether they have, the sufficient grant or express grant of authority from Congress to do rulemaking in a particular area, we're seeing agencies push the boundaries. Those two, as Judge said, they end up interacting in some respect, in the sense too that, Be careful what you wish for a federal agency, because if you're pushing the envelope on policy, you become a bigger target for someone to spend the time and the resources to bring an APA suit. And the result could be what we've seen here, which is striking down your actual substantive statutory authority. I'm not in the federal government at the moment. I can't articulate or pretend to speak for any particular agency, but I think there's some point it would be prudent for agencies to think hard about whether what they're doing is truly within the bounds of their authority, and if they can actually justify it based on the administrative record they have, because the result might be worse for them than where they started.
Judd, anything to add to that?
Nothing to add. I was going to say that it was something that this kind of flip-flopping is something that I think really drove the ultimate overruling of Chevron, is just this kind of disbelief that, courts should be deferring to agencies about what statutes mean when the agency, changes its interpretation of what a statute means according to an administration, which just seems kind of antithetical to the idea of statutory interpretation and statutes having meaning. And, famously and kind of humorously, Justice Thomas wrote a decision called Brand X that actually said, we still exercise Chevron deference to agencies, even when they change their position and change their interpretation of the statute. And he kind of not discreetly and kind of with some humor said, yeah, that was wrong. And I think that kind of reasoning, that it's just one of the things that I think led to the ultimate conclusion that Chevron had to go.
Right. I've got two related questions from the audience that are very narrow and neutral. So, Andrew, we'll start with you on these two. The first question is, what makes the FTC so aggressive, and why are they effectively trying to overrule decades or hundreds of years of law? The second narrow question is, can you discuss the significance of the FTC attempting to unilaterally renegotiate every private contract in the country if the decision had gone the other way? And the government could start inserting or removing bargain for terms, supposedly on behalf of employees and the little guy. What will stop them from taking over all of our remaining economic rights? All right.
There you go. I can't speak for the people at the agency, who made the decision here, or others in the government who might support it. I'm sure that there are strong held beliefs that non-competes are problematic. There's certainly reasonable positions that people can disagree as to the usefulness of non-competes and when they go too far and what those lines are. I'd respectfully say that that's why we have the states, and that Congress hasn't given that decision to the FTC or to DOJ for that matter. I can't speak for them or ultimately why they made the decision here and why they are pushing the envelope on inserting labor and employment considerations into what has otherwise been, effects on consumer test ultimately and the rule of reason for decades now. The second part of the question was, what's left of our economic rights? I think that's there's a real concern as to if, and this goes kind of back to the non-delegation doctrine argument that we've raised and preserved to the extent we need it at a other level. I think there's a real concern about what other types of rules the FTC could engage in if it has this unbounded unfair method of competition authority, particularly as they have interpreted that own authority, their own try to impose their own sort of pseudo guidelines through the 2022 policy statement that aren't really much of a guide. There's very little, I think, holding them back from many other types of rules. So there's no direct answer to that, but I do think that's why this is a very important case, and it is incumbent upon Congress to provide an intelligible principle for the rulemaking authority when it is granted, and to actually be clear when it is granting substantive rulemaking authority. In addition, particularly for rules of this kind of magnitude and scope, which, to get back to one of your earlier questions, Ashish, is kind of a preview of the major questions doctrine argument that the parties have raised and litigated below, but was ultimately not passed on by Judge Brown.
Judd, your thoughts?
I totally agree. I'll just echo the point that Andrew made that I 100% agree with. As we've said a few times, this case at one level was about the non-compete ban, and about, you know, the agency banning all non-compete agreements and trying to retroactively invalidate 30 million contracts. But at the other level, at the higher level, it's about the agency's rulemaking authority and Section 6 and the authority to basically prescribe by rule without regard to individual facts and circumstances and making any showing to some arbiter that a certain business practice, in this case, one that's been around for hundreds and hundreds of years, is kind of per se unfairly competitive. It's an unfair method of competition. And if the agency has the authority to do that, under this policy statement, the sort of standards that they've imposed upon themselves, which are very loosely called standards, they're very malleable. It only takes imagination to think about what other rules that the agency could in the future adopt and prescribe as unfair methods of competition. Certain kinds of mergers between businesses, certain kinds of business agreements, you know, between businesses and their customers. You know, all of a sudden it opens up this whole wide avenue for the agency to decide. Unelected agency, you know, majority of the commission to decide, you know, these kinds of things we think are unfairly competitive. And I think that that was just the larger importance of this case and continues to be the larger importance of this case until it is final, that is beyond even the scope of non-compete. So it's a good question and it's an important question to highlight.
Judd, you hit upon another important thing, which is, you know, a majority of the commission. So, you know, 3 out of 5, if the commission's at full strength, and unaccountable ultimately to the democratic process, you know, and I would posit a unconstitutionally structured agency for that reason.
And Judd, to that point, early in the tenure of this administration, there was a petition for a rulemaking to ban exclusive contracts, and the FTC is currently considering revisions to the merger form that you know, a lot of people consider very onerous. Okay, one more audience question, and then we'll close. This is from another very well informed listener. The non-compete issue seems to be one of several recent rulemaking actions that take a lose the battle but win the war philosophy. The rule is knowingly unlawful. In the question, but its real purpose is public persuasion. Any thoughts on that? Judd, let's start with you on this one.
In my personal view, it is definitely a losing battle. I thought our arguments are very strong. I'm very pleased that Judge Brown agreed with our arguments. You know, there's another judge in the country who has sort of, at least at a preliminary stage, disagreed with those arguments. I certainly would like to think that it was clear that that the agency didn't have authority to adopt this ban. But, of course, another judge has concluded otherwise. And even as to the broader question of the authority of the FTC to enact rules like this, as we've mentioned a couple of times, you know, there is one sort of substantive decision and one follow-on decision that have held otherwise and held that it does. So it's, you know, I agree with you. And in my heart of hearts, I think it's obvious to everyone that this is unlawful and that they're just doing this for PR points. I think it is possible that they are doing both. I think there's no doubt that there's political motivations at play here, given that President Biden announced this as a priority in an executive order very soon after taking office. So there's no doubt this is politically motivated and fulfilling, you know, what he viewed as a campaign promise. And while I want to agree with you on this, it's obvious that this was totally legally baseless. I'm trying to be a little bit fair to the agency, even though I think we're clearly right.
Andrew?
Yeah, I would just say that, you know, I think this is more of a topic of conversation than it was before the rule. So, you know, to the extent that public persuasion or politics were a driving force of it, as Judd outlined, it has had some effect. I mean, I go to kids' birthday parties, and if anyone's listening to see me there, we talk about the rule. We talk about, you know, that this is out there, and people have more questions about it. Partly that's because states have been looking at it, but you have seen, I think, other states, other efforts through legislative, democratically accountable mechanisms looking at this as they have authority to do. I think part of that is ascribed to the rulemaking. It is, if not increased the conversation. It has certainly kept non-competes as part of the public policy conversation across the country.
We do have another, you know, important audience question. Is there a plausible way for the FTC to draft a narrower lawful rule, or is it all or nothing? And Andrew, I know you talked about that earlier. So since we're at time, I'm going to close with a final question for both of you, which is, what is your confidence level that on a going forward basis that the rule will continue to be set aside? Judd, we'll start with you.
It's the question that every lawyer hates, every litigator hates. Look, I mean, Like I said, I feel very strongly that our arguments are right. I think Judge Brown's decision is very persuasive. As Andrew mentioned, we have other arguments for why the rule is invalid that Judge Brown didn't even address and didn't even need to address. So, I'm not going to put odds on it, but I feel very strong about our case, about our arguments, about being in the Fifth Circuit. You know, assuming it goes up to appeal, I think we're in a, you know, it's about as good of a court and a venue as you can be. So I feel good about it.
Andrew?
Yeah, I feel very good about it too. But yeah, don't want to put odds on it, as Judge said, but I think we feel very good about our case. There are many layers. You could peel back the onion, and we've got fallback arguments beyond what Judge Brown reached, and I think each and every one of them are correct. And ultimately, you know, I think that we have a very, very good chance of keeping this rule off the books.
Outstanding. Well, look, on behalf of the Federal Society, and our audience, thank you both very much for a very, very informative and interesting discussion. And Edith, back to you.
Yeah. Just ditto on behalf of the Federal Society. Thank you so much to Andrew and Jensen for speaking, and to you, Ashish, for moderating. We're so grateful for your time and expertise today. Thank you also to our audience for joining us. We really appreciate your active participation. You can stay up to date with announcements and upcoming webinars on our website, fedsoc.org, or on all major social media platforms. Thank you once more for tuning in, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.